On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
And welcome to The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. Ali Moore with you. Are you an avid viewer of the political cartoon? I was going to say reader, but not really appropriate, although if you look at some political cartoons, they do require a little bit of reading to understand them. But even if you don't like politics, sometimes cartoons can appeal to you. The poking fun, the analysis, the incisiveness. Who's your favourite? It's Mark Knight, Kathy Wilcox, David Rowe, First Dog on the Moon. There is such a very long list. The best Australian political cartoons for the year have been put together in a single book for your entertainment, and you'll meet the man responsible for that shortly. How did he choose what to put in and what to leave out? Such rich pickings from the year's political fodder. And of course, though, there has also been tragedy this year here and overseas. So also in this conversation hour, you'll meet aid worker Kate Learmonth. Kate's been heading the fight against Ebola with the International Red Cross Health Operations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's not all bad news. In fact, there has been a great deal of success. You'll meet her shortly as well. My co-host this morning, meteorologist extraordinaire, weatherman on your ABC TV News Breakfast, and downright nice bloke. Hello, Nate.
Oh, I was going to say, unfortunately, we couldn't get him.
You couldn't get him.
We'll have Nate instead.
Now, listen, I'm buttering you up so that, you know, you're extremely helpful over the next hour. Welcome to The Conversation Hour.
Thank you very much, Ali. This is my first time.
Not your first time in the studio, first time as co-host.
Yeah, far from. Regular listeners might recognise this voice. If not from the telly, then maybe from Thursdays, once a month, I come in and do a bit of geek club in the afternoons. But I tell you what, it is nice to be right off the back of telly and just taking a nice sit down and having a chat. It's wonderful.
And you don't even have to sit up straight because no one's really watching.
I am though, aren't I? Yeah. I've still got my waistcoat on, by the way, because of course it's Waistcoat Wednesday. But how about there we go. I'll just relax that off a bit.
Waistcoat Wednesday.
Every Wednesday.
Now it's a little bit hot for a waistcoat today, don't you think?
That's something we pointed out this morning, actually, that anyone around the country that wants to strip off a couple of layers today, I think that's okay.
But not all of them.
Well, you know, decency. It's not. We're not after 7 p.m.
That's the thing in telly, isn't it? That the joke used to always be that you'd have the suit on the top and the board shorts and the thongs underneath. You've said, I've done it.
Actually, see, that's a thing about doing the weather, standing at the wall. The camera gets all the way down to sort of mid-calf on me. So the best I could do is a thong on my feet,
and
a pair of
thongs. And even then you'd be lucky because if you had your legs out when you were sitting at the...
Yeah, you can't do that
on the couch. No, you'd be in trouble.
There is no
escaping. Actually hosting for the BBC out of Singapore, and anyone who's been to Singapore would be very familiar with the weather conditions in Singapore.
Of course.
Well, the air conditioning in the building broke and didn't just break for a couple of hours, actually broke for a good week. So trying to sit in that studio was an interesting experience. You still had to look like you were, presentable, but I can tell you there wasn't much... wasn't much clothing below. It was whatever you could do to maintain some sense of coolness.
I have a very similar story from my time in the Navy, being up in the tropics where the air conditioning broke down on the ship. And the same sort of thing, except of course you're in the military, so it's got to be very professional.
Did they allow you to go down to singlets or something?
Yeah, we went down to t-shirts and stubbies with, believe it or not, Crocs, if you weren't doing important work that needed safety boots. It was very tough, especially when you're out at sea, because there is no just calling the aircon repair person to come down. You've got to stay on patrol and just put up with it.
Really? So what about you? I suppose the onboard ship technicians got short shrift.
Frantically working for it. But, you can only carry so many spare parts. So sometimes if it's not an essential thing, you just got to grit your teeth and bear it.
Well, listen, I suppose in some ways that's sort of, this is all very much luxurious compared to what some people face when they're particularly out on some of these properties in northern Victoria.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I've heard some commentary that we could be seeing some of the world's first climate refugees in our own country, because we've got indigenous populations that are so remote and so underserviced, where there are places that don't have things like air conditioning. And some of those places as we speak, are getting up into the mid to high 40s. And we're, in fact, there's a community in South Australia tomorrow that's looking at a top of 49.
But even in Victoria and in the north of Victoria, we're heading for some very, well, potentially record-breaking temperatures, aren't we?
Yeah, it'll be 46s, 47s up in the northwest there. Of course, the fire danger is following. It's been a very tough and long start to summer so far. And I think this week is definitely going to be a standout week for 2019 in terms of the heat.
So it's not, I mean, one of the, particularly in Victoria where we haven't had the bushfires that New South Wales and Queensland and even Western Australia has had, this is our first really big week of weather. Do you think that it's just going to be the first of many?
I suspect so. So part of the problem that we're having in the east of the country is actually driven not by anything that's happening near us. We're used to talking about things like El Nino, which is a Pacific Ocean phenomenon, and that's largely what drives our weather here on the east coast. But at the moment, we're actually turning our eyes to the Indian Ocean and off the northwest shelf of the country, because temperatures of the ocean there are a little bit cooler than normal, and that means there's not as much evaporation going on. So we're not getting the moisture being pumped into the north of Australia to create lots of thunderstorms and the wet season up that way. When that happens, that means we've got cloud cover that helps to literally shade the earth from the sun. Now, because we haven't had that, all that heat has been building and building and building and then pulling down into Western Australia and then being dragged eastwards by cold fronts. And because that air is so dry, these cold fronts haven't brought much rain. And the thing is, that Indian Ocean, that part of the Indian Ocean is slowly starting to warm, but it probably won't get back to normal levels until January. So we could be seeing a very late wet season. So bad news in the tropics, where they've had about 20% of the rain they'd have normally. But that means that until that happens, we're going to keep experiencing this kind of heat regularly. Because even though we haven't had massive fires so far in Victoria, we certainly have had some blazes.
Well, we've got fires in East Gippsland at the moment.
And smoke shrouding much of the east of the state. But we have been seeing this heat every, 2 weeks or so. We've been getting these spikes in temperature. Luckily, so far, they've been relatively short-lived, but that's not the case this time.
And that was a point that's been made by emergency services, is that we get these spikes. In Melbourne, we tend to get relief in the evening or relief overnight, but in the north of the state, they don't. It stays hot.
Yeah, these cold fronts haven't been pushing that really chilly air right up into the north of the state, though they have been copying often the increase in the wind speed and sometimes wind direction. So that's when it gets gusty and helps to ramp up that fire danger even more and causes really, really concerning conditions. We've been so lucky so far this year not to have had any of those huge blazes, which of course Victoria understands very well, right? We have a recent memory of some of the worst conditions we've ever seen in Australia. And well, fingers crossed, we're not going to be seeing anything like that, but it's a real risk.
So I can see now why you're not, unlike most of the presenters on ABC TV News Breakfast. In fact, most of the presenters on the ABC full stop are taking a break. You're not.
No, because summer's the time for weather. And I don't want to sound too excited, but from the meteorologist point of view, it's certainly incredibly interesting because we're going to have cyclones to talk about in a second. There's these heat waves. We're probably going to end up with some floods at some point.
And this is all good news to you and everyone out there's going, no.
I know it's awful. Although it's funny because good news for one person is bad news for another, right? And vice versa. Often, like the floods, Pip Courtney, who people might know
presents
from
the country hour. Landline.
Yeah.
The television version of country hour.
Exactly. Yeah. Pip, just when I first started at the ABC, we had a really big flooding event up north. I said, hopefully these floodwaters subside soon and, isn't it terrible for everyone? And she literally told me off. She caught me in the corridor and was like, right, you, no more, because these guys up there, these farmers and families, they'll lose a fence. That's okay, because they need the water that badly. And now 2 years on, with the drought where it is now, even in Victoria, where if you drive around, it looks quite green still compared to what's happening further north. But the soil profile is so dry, we really need those floodwaters. Mm.
Yeah, that is, I've had exactly the same experience that you sit, and particularly, you know, in the luxury of your air-conditioned studio in Melbourne, you sit there and say, oh, it's weird, it's going to rain on the weekend. What a disappointment. And, of course, it's not. For those who, where the weather really matters, where it's not just a matter of social inconvenience, but it's a matter of livelihoods, then, you know, that's good, as you say. What might not be good for one is fantastic for another.
I tell you what really annoys people as well. There's a
there's quite a lot
well,
on
yeah,
that list,
yeah,
can
but,
I just say.
Yeah, of course. But in the weather space, weather's a weird science because it grew not as a science in its own right to begin with. It grew from people already having an understanding of the weather, and some of the language that we have reflects that. So some of the words that we use as official meteorological terms are quite fun, like my personal favourite, which is sultry.
Which is what? Sultry.
Sultry.
Sultry,
yeah,
yes.
Which is, you know, a hot, humid,
slightly muggy,
kind of gross night when you're just kind of just feeling all kinds of upset. But a day with no rain is a fine day.
Ah.
And that brings so much expectation for people. But then, of course, there are people that absolutely hate a fine day and they actually quite like it when it's a little bit drizzly and chilly and cloudy. I mean, I don't know who they are, but apparently they exist.
So what are your other favourite terms? I've never thought about that, the language, the use of language with the weather.
Yeah, well, one of the things I love is that I'm not entirely sure why it's the case, but meteorologists really hold tight to their Latin when it comes to naming clouds. I'm sure it's just a matter of history and you know, just tradition. But new clouds are sometimes described, not all that often, but occasionally, and they always sort of shoehorn in a Latin-ish sounding term. And,
to show
and
how
I love
terribly
it.
Clever they are.
Yeah, yeah. Like one of my favourites in terms of how it forms as well, because it's quite interesting, is pyrocumulonimbus. So it's a cumulonimbus cloud.
What's the pyro bit?
Fire. So it's when a bushfire is so intense that the heat causes the air above it to rise. And
it becomes a cloud.
And then a
thunderstorm. So it's not smoke haze. It is actually a cloud.
Yeah. And that's when you hear about storms, well, fires creating their own fire weather and storms, which can then create dry lightning, causing more fires. It's a really interesting sort of phenomenon. But it has a beautiful name, I think. Pyrocumulonimbus.
A beautiful name for something that's so potentially horrific
yeah.
with what's going on below. You are listening to Nate Byrne. He's the weatherman on your ABC TV News Breakfast program. He's here all summer, so never fear. He will be here to provide the very latest information. And our first guest is a man who has spent his, most recent weeks completely immersed in the world of political cartoons. Russ Radcliffe, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
You have... is this your 16th best Australian political cartoon book?
I started in 2003.
Well, that
so,
would be.
Yeah, it's sort of quite a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of cartoons.
It is a lot of cartoons.
A lot of thrown away cartoons as well, you know, a lot of sort of edited out.
And I love the PR blurb. Celebrate another glorious year of achievement in Australian politics with our humble, balanced and always scrupulously fair cartoonists as they pay tribute to the selfless service of our leaders.
Well, that's fair enough, isn't it?
Not the slightest bit
accurate?
Tongue-in-cheek there.
Yeah, where would we be without our political cartoonists?
So the question has to be, how do you pick them?
That's a very... Well, I guess I try to select a representative selection from cartoonists all around the country, and I also try to get create a narrative of the year's events with the cartoons. So there may be better cartoons that are left out, but because I need to create a narrative, some of them
they didn't suit your purpose. So
yeah,
that's
right. You can't have sort of 200 cartoons on Donald Trump. You have to.
Although
cover.
We could have, I'm sure.
well, David Rowe has probably done at least 200 on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
This year.
And I think next year we'll have 200 on Boris Johnson.
Yeah. So we've had quite a few on Boris already.
And many on both of them, I've noticed actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
twins joined at the hip very often.
A very direct line drawn between the two. Do you spend all year on this, or is it a bit of a quick rush at the end?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I pay attention all the year to what's going on.
Well,
obviously,
you'd be stuffed if you didn't.
Well,
yeah,
you would.
That
yeah.
many.
But then there's a kind of an intense sort of 2 month period where I amass all the cartoons and just go through them, select them into topics, and.
Because you cop, you with each cartoon, or not with each cartoon, but all the way through the book, you also have pertinent quotes and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So do you start with the events of the year and the quotes, then backfill the cartoons, or do you start the other way around?
Yes. No, a bit of each. I mean, obviously you have to cover all the major events and all the major personalities. And then I look for the best cartoons on each of those topics, and then I look for ridiculous quotes that explain what happened. I think when I first started doing the book, I just used to put the cartoons in. And I think that was a mistake, because cartoons really are all about context. They're about the political context. If you don't have the context for them, they don't really mean anything. And they're just not effective unless you know what was going on that particular week.
They're never presented as standalone.
No, they're not intended to be.
In a paper, in
context. That's absolutely what they are. They're contextual things. And without that, sure, you can look at the artwork and you can appreciate that, and maybe there's a bit of a gag there which you can enjoy. But they're political commentary, and that's what they're designed. They're designed to sit next to thoughtful, textual arguments, in a sense. I mean, without that kind of that more thoughtful background, they're just propaganda. So they need the balance of that kind of more thoughtful prose, if you like.
Here's a very naive question, but when you're a political cartoonist, are you told what to do a cartoon on?
Well, I'm not a political cartoonist.
No, I know, but you walk the corridors of power with these cartoonists. I'm curious.
I patrol the corridors of power. I think some certainly would be, but I mean, the best editorial cartoonists would be given a free run. I think it depends on the newspaper, but I think most of them, our finest cartoonists, would be given a relatively free run. Certainly in terms of their opinions, they'd be given a free run. I mean, you can't imagine telling Kathy Wilcox what to put in a cartoon.
No.
I mean, somebody of that, or John Kadelka.
Or David Rowe.
Yeah,
or,
I mean, John Kadelka was at The Australian, you know. I mean, he's now at the Saturday paper. You can't imagine that he was told what to do by the editor of The Australian. I mean, his views came across very strongly in his cartoons. Mm. So, and I guess in the old days, Bill Leake, when he was a bleeding heart lefty, was at The Australian, and he was very much counter to the editorial line of the newspaper. So that happens. I think most cartoons have their own views of things. I think it's best to see them in terms of commentators rather than, I think they're not just there for a bit of a giggle. They're there
to add to the commentary,
yeah, and they have very distinct perspectives on situations, and that's what makes them interesting, I think.
And distinct art styles. Flicking through, you can see that as some should probably be hung in portrait galleries, the level of detail and the amount of work that must go into these to churn them out at such a rate is just incredible.
But that's one of the things I was saying, is I find sometimes political cartoons are too dense. Yeah. And I suppose if you do look at them as a piece of commentary, then you would give them the same amount of time as you would to read a commentary piece.
I think so. I mean, some are very direct, very simple, and, a couple of seconds, you get the joke and laugh or not. But sometimes they require real attention and real thought. I mean, the cartoonist who required the most attention, of course, is no longer cartooning. Bruce Petty. I mean, Bruce Petty. It took the same length of time to read his cartoon as it would say 800 words of prose. Because they're really complex images, and you have to work with them a little bit.
So, what makes a good cartoon, do you think?
Well, for me, I think there's got to be a political intelligence behind it. I think that's really important. So it's not enough just to have a take the piss out of a politician. It's not. I mean, that's fine, but it's not enough.
Clever.
It's not enough. You've also got to have a political idea behind it, and I also think that some of the best ones have quite. They have distinct voices and distinct opinions, so I don't think you can have a cartoonist who simply changes his or her mind every cartoon. You've got to have a distinct point of view, I think, to be a great cartoonist. I think all our best cartoonists, had distinct points of view. Obviously, you've got to be able to draw.
Oh, yes.
that's the other thing. But, there are a lot of elements in great cartoons, I think. I suppose my idea is that I take them seriously. I don't think they're just throwaway items in the newspaper. I see them as quite, a serious commentary and serious, give you serious insight into to the political world.
When you say Serious Insight, they're probably the cartoons I like best, the ones that don't necessarily scream, I'm just taking the mickey, but really, really make you think. Like the one of a bishop in her red shoes, as if she's in The Wizard of Oz and she's going home, clicking
with
her heels.
Very grumpy look on her face.
or the one I know that's one of your favourites, the Black Fern from New Zealand.
Pat Campbell from the Canberra Times did a really wonderful cartoon. Well, it's an image which is of the silver fern, the New Zealand silver fern, but each of the fronds is an individual Islamic figure, and it's about the Christchurch terror attacks. It's an extraordinary image. It's not funny, but it's an extraordinary image, really. A very simple, direct.
But it's also, there is, beautiful thing. On the face of it, very simple, but the closer you look, it's actually quite
It's incredibly detailed because they're all individual figures on the front. It's not...
Very clever.
Yeah, it's a wonderful... And he won a Walkley Award for that, and quite justifiably.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you've got I just mentioned somebody like David Pope, who's one of our more, cerebral cartoonists. One of my favourites of the year was... He drew on a famous cartoon from the Vietnam War, which was the shadow of a B-52 flying over a paddy field, and you've got the people below in the shadow of the B-52. So this was a Vietnam era one. Well, he's drawn on that for inspiration, and he's now got a drone flying above a family, and there's just the shadow there, and it's about robo debt. So that image. Kind of, it looks at that whole problem of artificial intelligence and that kind of artificial intelligence in terms of warfare and welfare. You know, it's kind of, it's a really large comment about the direction of our societies, and I that's the sort of thing I really like. It's a simple cartoon in some ways, but it's got depths and breadths to it, which I really love.
What are some other favourites?
There's a fantastic Kathy Wilcox, during the election campaign. ScoMo basically sequestered the entire cabinet, because he didn't want them out there making ridiculous statements. So Dutton and Abbott and all these people. So she's got them basically all sequestered in the basement. And
it's like, oh, there you are.
You can come out now. It's all over. We've won.
It's safe. It's safe to be seen.
Yeah.
And there's some other very simple ones, for example, about media censorship. There's the newsreader. Who's literally saying, that, and in fact, it's not a newsreader, it's a newsreader in a policeman's uniform saying, and the news tonight. Oh, not that one.
Peter McMullen at the Sunday Mail. That's a very nice cartoon. Yeah. There's also a David Rowe on the same thing, which is Peter Dutton sitting with his feet on the desk, and there's the little ABC logo squashed on the bottom of his boot, which is an extraordinary cartoon.
And another one where the journalists with gags on are named the Quiet Australians.
Quiet Australians. Yes. Australians.
There's quite a few about the Quiet Australians, actually.
Well, that represents my prejudice. I thought it was an important topic, so I wanted to... The Quiet Australians is kind of less of a description and more of an order these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you feel that a successful cartoonist has to have a point of view and has to have a slant, do you, as someone who curates a collection of cartoons, do you come at it from a particular...
Oh, invariably, yeah. You couldn't pretend not to. I mean, because the ones that I find to be really insightful... I don't know. I think the cartoons that you laugh at are often the ones that align most clearly with
that
your
you
own
agree
viewpoint.
With.
I think so. It's very hard to laugh at a cartoon that attacks something that you feel very strongly about. There are no cartoons in here which I think are racist, for example. I just don't put them in. There are cartoonists who do those kind of things. I just don't want to give them any space, so I don't put them in.
So what do you... And I know it's not a political cartoon, but the Lunik cartoon about the prams and the mums and the babies slipping out of prams and all of that sort of thing.
You're throwing me to the lions here, aren't you?
No, but I'm actually sort of curious. I mean, what did you... I mean, he was making a point and obviously has now fought that point publicly backwards and forward, including with his own family. But what did you make of that?
Yeah, actually, Lunik never goes into this cartoon collection he never has them because he does his own book, so it doesn't go into this. Yeah, I thought the reaction was excessive. I mean, I know he has a little bit of history with that kind of very quite conservative views about gender roles. But I thought it was quite excessive, the reaction to it, as these things are, you know, once they hit social media, everybody sort of
jumps on a bandwagon,
piles in with a super strong self-righteous opinion.
But I guess if a cartoon is there to be part of a commentary, then what he did was stir up commentary.
He did.
I mean, you know, that's his job.
And this, the Mark Knight cartoon of tennis player Williams.
Yes, Serena Williams.
Serena Williams. That was last year.
I was going to say, was that last year? Because I didn't notice it in this book.
No, it's not.
And that was complaints about how he had drawn Serena.
Mark Knight, I'm sure, is not even vaguely racist. But the fact is, he drew a cartoon. He drew a woman who looked very much like those little gollywog stickers you used to get on jam jars, you know. So he automatically referenced that sort of that history of representation. But I think the problem there was the fact that the press then piled in and said, well, this is just only about free speech. It's not about anything else. And it wasn't a great episode in Australian media.
You're listening to The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Ali Moore with you. Nate Byrne is my co-host. And Ross Radcliffe is the editor of the Best Australian Political Cartoons for 2019. And we have just been joined as well by Kate Learmonth. She's a health coordinator for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. And she's been working with the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ebola virus disease operation. Kate Learmonth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's such a frightening disease, Ebola, isn't it? You just say the name and everyone cringes.
It is. I mean, it's a bit like one of those Hollywood zombie movies. It can be quite scary, but once you understand it and you kind of know what's happening, it becomes a little bit more demystified. And it is actually treatable. We have some really new drugs that have come out in this response, and they're actually very, very effective if you get treated in time. So it's like a lot of things. Once we begin to understand it, it becomes a little bit less scary.
I know people are worried about Ebola, but it's not quite like you see in the movies, is it? It's not like, you know, people have blood spurting out of every single orifice and going crazy, but it is a really horrific disease if you're not getting treated.
Yeah. It is. And I mean, the first symptoms are very much like the flu or malaria, and that's why a lot of people don't think they have Ebola. They think they've got malaria or something else. But if it left untreated and it gets to those final stages, that is where you see the hemorrhagic side of it and you see the blood, and that's where it gets very scary.
So you spent 9 months in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You got back a couple of months ago. How did you come to this? How did you find your way to the Congo and Ebola?
It's been a journey. I've been doing international work for about 10 years. I started in the Philippines in 2008 with the World Health Organization.
Are you a doctor, a nurse, medical?
I'm a public health specialist, but I'm not clinical. So I come from a research science background, and I'm a bit of an epi geek, as I like to call it. I like my data. But I've been very lucky in working with UNICEF in Haiti on the cholera response and a number of different, the United Nations Population Fund, and now most recently with the Red Cross. And Ebola is quite scary, but we're talking about this 10th outbreak as Ebola in a conflict zone. And so you've got these huge complexities around a very infectious disease, as well as conflict and a humanitarian emergency that has been going on for a number of years. So it's I'm not quite sure where I'll be next year coming up. But it's part of the journey as well. And so I very much see what emergencies, and if I'm available, I'll go. It could be anywhere. I've been to Fiji with Cyclone Winston, to Northern Cameroon on a nutrition crisis, and so it's very rewarding work, very challenging work, but I do love it.
So you land in the Congo, and as you say, I mean, this is not the first outbreak, so there's obviously background here. Where do you start? You as Kate Learmonth.
So I started in Kinshasa, where I had the opportunity to meet the president of the National Society of the Red Cross in the Congo. And then I, after a little bit of time in Kinshasa, fly to Goma, where the base was. And so as the health coordinator, my role is not so much in the field. It's managing and coordinating and attending a lot of meetings. And so what they say, the Emergency Operations Center was based in a town in Goma, which is essentially the capital of that region. And so I spent most of my time there. And then we had Red Cross teams. We had over 1,300 volunteers active on the response, doing what we call safe and dignified burials, so burying people who were suspected to have died, and very important to decrease transmission. We have volunteers going door to door and talking about the risk of Ebola. We have volunteers doing what they call infection prevention control, so screening people in health facilities and things like that. And so for me, it was really trying to understand what's happening, because it's so complex and it's such a fairly large region. I mean, the Congo is a very large country. And so for me, the first step is just trying to understand, to meet my team and to talk with people and to understand what's happening and what the challenges are. As part of this, I mean, the logistics alone, you have to ship in a huge amount of burial kits and different things. And so it's a very, very complex operation.
And that the biggest, I mean, you talked there about volunteers, and that is key, isn't it? Because it is so much about community trust, and there has been so much mistrust or distrust around Ebola.
Absolutely. I mean, the great thing with the Red Cross movement is it's all about the volunteers. And I'm a paid professional. I'm going in there to assist and coordinate, but it's the volunteers on the ground who do such an amazing work. And they're the ones that are working in their community. And the community trust is such an important role, particularly in this Ebola response with the conflict. Because with conflict, you have a lot of mistrust anyway. Ebola brought in a lot of money, a lot of resources. It brought in a lot of expats, but also a lot of people from Kinshasa. And, you know, in Kinshasa, they speak Lingala, whereas in northern Congo, they tend to speak Swahili. And so as well as French, you have a very different cultural group as well. And that really contributed a bit to the mistrust. And so the community volunteers who go door to door, and they'd also listen to them. And this was crucial because, you know, we know that just talking to someone and saying, "Don't get Ebola," is not going to work. And so you really need to engage with the women's groups and the community leaders and the school children. And the community volunteers are the ones who are able to do that. And so they do an amazing job. I take my hats off to them.
Now, Ebola's not one of those diseases. It's a virus, right, for starters. It's not one of those that we're going to be able to vaccinate away, is it? Like smallpox or anything like that. But yeah. Because there's a pool in, is it bats, I believe?
Yeah, so I mean, there is a very effective vaccine that's been deployed. There have been over 200,000 people vaccinated. They've just brought in a second vaccine. So the vaccines work, they're highly effective. And part of what they're doing is a ring strategy. So every time someone is a suspected case, they go and they vaccinate anyone who's come into contact with them.
Why don't they just vaccinate everyone?
There's not enough vaccine. but at the same time, that leads into that, because smallpox was eradicated because, you're right, there was no pool, natural reservoir. With Ebola, there is a natural reservoir in the jungle. They think it is bats, but they're not entirely sure.
Right.
And they haven't actually traced patient zero in this outbreak, this 10th outbreak. And so that makes it incredibly difficult as well. But, you know, if someone who thinks they has Ebola gets tested and treated and isolated as quickly as possible, they have a very good survival chance.
For the most part, it's just sort of typical emergency care, right? Like getting lots of fluids. And
absolutely.
I know a lot of people don't survive Ebola, but that's largely because they're not getting access to that care, right?
About 2/3 of people will die from Ebola. And that part of that is people delay seeking care. So we know that they average about between 6 and 7 days between the onset of symptoms and seeking medical care. And that you actually can't transmit Ebola unless you are symptomatic. So unless you are actually showing signs and you're sick, that's the only time you begin to transmit Ebola.
And it's only transmitted through bodily fluids, right? So it's not airborne. You can't get it like you can get the cold or other diseases.
Exactly. It's not airborne. I mean, as a bit of an epi geek and a public health geek, it's an incredibly interesting little virus.
I'm on board with you, 100%. This is right up my alley.
But that's exactly it. And the actually best defense is basic hygiene. Basic hygiene, you know, in all of the Red Cross staff had a no-touch policy. So for 9 months, we weren't really allowed to touch anybody. And that's, every day I would go to a meeting and I would have to get my temperature checked and I'd have to wash my hands. In the very Ebola hotspot areas, you'd have to wash your shoes with chlorinated water. And you could get your temperature checked like 5 times a day sometimes. So there are some very well known and quite easy measures to try and reduce the risk.
And when we were talking earlier about the distrust in the community and how you had feedback from volunteers, that actually changed how you did some things, didn't it?
Absolutely.
And I was really curious about the clear burial bags. I know that sounds slightly, perhaps a bit too much detail, but it's fascinating it's important.
It is a fantastic example of what happens when you listen to communities. So early in the response, so late 2018, we were having a lot of trouble with the safe and dignified burials. People were hiding their family members, and we know that, you know, at the time of death with Ebola, it's a very, very high risk time to transmit it to your loved ones. And actually, that's one of the ways was at a funeral of a local healer where it really jumped and expanded very quickly.
Because they all touched him.
Yes, and that's part of the ritual. And so that's also why we call it safe and dignified burials, because it's about safety, it's about reducing the risk, but it's also dignified. And what's the biggest difficulty in this is people can't do their normal routine around death. And so one of the things that they also saying to us as part of the feedback is that they really didn't like the body bags. They were black. They couldn't see their family member. There were a lot of rumours that the bodies were being mutilated and things like that. And so what the team did was it was before I arrived, and so they listened to the communities and they were able to implement what we call a clear view or transparent body bag. And so these are white and they have a clear, transparent zip-up part, and then over that they have another white zip-up. So you can actually open that and the family member can see their loved ones, and that's been really, really important. And one of the things that we still are kind of trying to find a solution to is they felt that the spirit of their loved one couldn't pass through the body bag, and that was also really important to them. We're also talking about such a culturally diverse group. We're talking about culturally diverse. We have Christians, but there's also Muslim communities as well as different faiths, And so you also need to adapt it to the different communities and the different cultural beliefs. And part of that is really working with the local community, listening to them. And what the volunteers do is they do demonstrations and they go to the community and say that this is what happens, this is what we do, and they'll get a community to actually maybe help them to set up the body bag. And that's really, really important so that they understand why it's important, why it's necessary, and hopefully if the time comes, they will then allow our volunteers in to... And every time the volunteers go in, a burial team goes in, they negotiate with the family.
And it is burial.
It is. And so the first thing they do is they go in and talk with the family, and they will decontaminate the body with like sprayed chlorine and the area around it. And before they do that, though, they'll actually take a test. So they'll do an oral swab to test for Ebola. And then they will sometimes wait for the test result, or if the family agrees, they'll directly, after they have secured the body in the body bag, they will go to burial. But it really depends what the family wants. You know, they've buried, I don't know what they're up to, over 13,000 people have been buried, but only less than 1% were positive. And that's part of a kind of a blanket measure for anyone from those areas who could potentially be a suspected deaths. But when they actually do the testing, they find that a lot less are.
So they bury them as if they're an Ebola.
They're a suspected.
But they're not.
No. So
because did you just say less than 1%?
Yeah, less than 1%.
That is a tiny proportion.
And that's mainly at the moment because up in April, we were seeing 20 cases a day. More recently, we've been seeing 20 cases a week. We've seen a slight resurgent now because the conflict has also come out as well, which is creating some difficulties in access. But at the time when we were seeing 20 cases a day, then obviously that was much, much higher positive deaths. Now that when you're only seeing 20 cases a week, that's a lot less. And so it's a little bit depending on how many cases you're seeing. But the government decided that that was the policy. And so so we all worked with it to make sure. Because we know that it can be very... Someone can die from something other than Ebola, but still have had Ebola. And so that becomes a significant risk as well.
How do you deal with the various militia groups in the area? I mean, what kind of negotiations take place?
Yeah.
Because it's an incredibly complicated military and political situation there.
It is.
So do you have specialists who negotiate with the various militia groups, or how does that work?
So there's about over 200 active armed groups in those regions, and some of them are very well organised, very military-like, and some of them are just bandits with guns who hold people up. And you see that whole range. A lot of the time, because it's a community volunteer and they're well connected with the community leaders, they will negotiate access.
Right.
As the Red Cross movement, you know, we cannot use armed escorts. And so we rely very much on the respect of the emblem and things like that in negotiation. Mm. But if there is any risk as well, then you know, they also will pull out, pull the volunteers out for a period. And that has happened in different cases.
Yeah. But there have been many deaths, haven't there, amongst healthcare workers? Have they been targeted as part of the conflict?
It's a bit of both. I mean, Ebola has put in a lot of money into those areas. And, you know, this comes from 25 years of conflict. There hasn't been a lot of resources put into that until now. Mm. And so because there's been a lot of money, it's also has created a bit of a target. There's also been a lot of rumours going around. And a lot of probably active targeting as well. It's very difficult. We know one of our colleagues from the WHO was assassinated in one of the areas as well. And so he was specifically targeted.
Because of his Ebola work or...?
I don't know the complexities of it, but he was an epidemiologist with the WHO from Cameroon. Mm. And so... There was some rumours that something else was happening, but you don't know. And most recently, 2 weeks ago, they did target and kill some of the Ebola workers as well. So it's a little bit of, you can be caught in the crossfire, but it can also be a targeting. It could also be to do with local politics as well, and because of all, you have all the different groups, armed groups. So
I cannot imagine working like this. You've got your temperature taken five times a day, you're washing your shoes and your hands and all of that, and then that risk on top of it. Mm. It must just absolutely run you down. How long were you in the Congo for?
So I was a health coordinator for 9 months.
Whoa.
And I mean, I was also very lucky. I mean, Goma is much more of a safe area, but my teams were very much out there, and it's not even that. You know, we also have a number of volunteers that could also be suspected cases. So there was a case of one of our volunteers who unfortunately lost his wife and a newborn child to Ebola from the health facility. So it was transmitted while they were at the health facility, and then he became a suspected case. And then he had to go to an Ebola treatment centre to be tested. And so there's the risk of violence. There's also some cases where some of the youth were getting quite angry because they were also seeing, you know, this fear, a lot of fear, but also, you know, they were seeing people from the community being paid and they weren't receiving any. And so they were actually targeting the burial teams as well. Mm-hmm. And that required going to the local community leaders and negotiating and sitting down with the youths and then trying to get them involved. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of different risks involved.
Is there any historical legacy with the response to AIDS in what was then Zaire? I know in the late 80s in Zaire, the idea, because a lot of people thought that, there was a theory that AIDS had jumped the barrier, the species barrier in Zaire, I believe, at that time. And people in Zaire, or the Congo, were incredibly suspicious, and they saw this as a CIA plot. And it was in the papers in the Congo all the time. People would just say to you, this is a CIA plot to undermine this country. And given the history of kind of foreign meddling in that part of the world, I guess it wasn't entirely unreasonable to be a little paranoid about it. Is there any legacy of that kind of thing?
I mean, there is some of the mistrust comes from people believing Ebola is a business. I mean, at the same time, in December, you had an election, you had a change in government after 30 years. And so actually some of the areas considered to be hotspot areas weren't allowed to vote in that election. Mm. So there was also a lot of that added complexity as well. Mm. But it's more that it's seen, some communities don't believe Ebola does exist. Right. And that's partly because for many people, Ebola is not their primary concern.
No,
I mean, they're in a conflict area, they need to get water, need to get their children to school, they need to find food. And so that's also one thing where the response was probably a little bit slow in that trying to really talk with communities about what are their other needs. Mm. But we are getting there, and so now we have what we're calling these Ebola Plus, and so it's looking at, well, what's your primary concern and how can we help to address that?
Mm. So do you think that this... You have been successful. This is the 10th outbreak. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you can eradicate, but is it something that you now have well contained, do you believe?
I mean, the 9th outbreak happened just before this 10th outbreak, and they contained it within 3 months. It was actually it went very, very well. And then I think they were actually doing like a final lessons learned little workshop with the team when they got the call that Ebola had been declared. So they declared Ebola on the 1st of August 2018, but they expect to have found cases from May. So it had been going for a little bit before they detected it. No one expected this one to go that long, but it is the first time Ebola has been in a conflict area. And so, yes, but I think we also need to learn how to adapt in a conflict area. And it makes things much more challenging. I mean, just also the sheer size of the area, but also logistics. Everything has to be flown in. The roads are impassable. Wet season, I mean, it's incredibly difficult to move things as well. But what's really interesting in the last couple of months is we've seen a transition for Ebola being in the urban areas to moving to the rural areas. So we've seen a decrease in cases and we've seen a kind of change in the population as well. That's changing a little bit with the conflict that's kind of heating up a little bit at the moment because you're getting a lot of displaced people as well. And so there's a very big fear that this might get into the populations that are moving. So there's a lot of lessons here. It's personally and professionally, it's been an incredibly interesting response.
Well, it's just extraordinary work that you do. And just with a one-word answer, if you've had Ebola, you can't get it again.
They are actually unsure.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a whole other conversation we don't have time for. But thank you so much for sharing the work you do, because it is something that, you know, I think people think about even on the other side of the world, because it's an extraordinary disease, and you're much admired for what you do. And the book, Russ Radcliffe, Best Australian Political Cartoons for 2019. And a big thank you to Nate Byrne for being my co-host here on The Conversation Hour for the first time. And thank you, too, for listening.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.